There will be spoilers ahead. Lots of spoilers, so be careful, won't you?
Here at Max Mike Movies, we are on a quest to dream the impossible dream. Walking down the road one day, doo-da, doo-da. Yes, we're on a quest, all these little people all around us. But first, let us groove on this field of poppies.
I think you already have.
Okay, we're not actually looking for the truth of life, as Tom T-Bone Stankus would have us do. But we are, in fact, getting into our series, Didn't Win, about movies that should have won Best Picture, maybe, but didn't. And as the more cunning among you may have sussed out, this week's entry is The Wizard of Oz, which lost Best Picture of 1939 to some weird mashup of 20th century Indian history and Peter Pan, called Gandhi and Windy, I think.
No.
That was it. Don't worry, we'll get to it.
But before sussed we do, out. We told them!
I am your host, the man with no home and no heart, Max Levine, and over there, crawling from under the remains of a Kansas farmhouse, is the man with no brain and no metal, Mike Luce. Perform a complex musical number for us, Mike.
Oot blat blat, oot blat, oot blat blat.
So moving. But before we get to that, we have to get to...
Poll question.
Last time we asked you, what is your favorite filmic romance? Gay, straight, miscellaneous, any kind.
Dogs and cats living together.
Dr. Lauren Buxbaum responded with Shrek and Fiona. Yeah, that's a nice one.
Okay.
Margaret Trouth?
Trouth
said, "Who's afraid of Virginia Woolf?" I saw it in high school, and the first act felt like the way my parents jokingly sniped at each other. It goes off the rails, but there's really something there that feels familiar and good. Margaret, honey, are you okay? That is not what I would have expected.
No, see our entire episode on Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Val Coons,
who?
Empress Supreme of Queuing the Footsteps, the second greatest galactic podcast in galacticness, says, "This is an easy one for me. Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall into Have and Have Not. Ah, yes. Their real-life romantic spark feeds their interactions, and you can feel the heat between them." And Dave Mackman chimes in with, "Plus Hoagie Carmichael." I never thought of them as a throuple, but okay.
No,
could be. You never know.
Well, it can't be a throuple because only one of them appeared on the Flintstones.
That's true, Mr. Hoagie Carmichael.
Yeah.
Yabba dabba dabba doo. Keith Wright says there's an independent film called The Velocity of Gary. Starring Thomas Jane, Vincent D'Onofrio, and Salma Hayek. Wow, there's a cast. That's cool. Which has one of the best screen kisses. It's between Thomas Jane and Vincent D'Onofrio. The Kingpin and the Punisher making out. I may have to see this.
I don't think that's what they're playing.
Crazy good. XOXO. I forget. There's also, apparently he forgot, but not for very long, that there's a great film called Love Jones. Oh, wasn't he the guy from Harlem? Love Jones?
No.
Okay, which stars Nia Long and Lorenz Tate. I doubt if many people will suggest films with people of color. Painful, but probably factually accurate. There's also East Palace, West Palace, a gay Chinese film. Really sweet and heartbreaking. Okay, I'm sorry to say I've never heard of any of those.
But still.
Adam Mark says, quote, "So what happened after the prince climbed up the tower and rescued her? She rescues him right back." This is Pretty Woman, 1990. Edward, a rich venture capitalist, Mitt Romney in the making, by chance encounters Vivian, a streetwise prostitute who can drive a stick. Taking a shine to her, he means car, he hires her as an escort to accompany him to a few social events during a touchy business acquisition. Trouble ensues when they fall in love with each other and struggle to bridge the gap between their worlds. This film could have been a forgettable mess. Hooker with a Heart of Gold and Mr. Big meet up. Hilarity ensues. Groan. I think that was the plot of Sex and the City, really. But director Gary Marshall, rest in peace, wisely and graciously allows Richard Gere and Julia Roberts to flesh out the two stock characters into vulnerable and flawed but hopeful people, both of whom maintain burdensome ironclad armored personas in their respective worlds. And then, with each other, they allow their defenses to crack. They're both in immense pain, and their salvation is in one another. It's a charming masterpiece and the film I always go to on a snow day or if I've been feeling unwell. The scenes where the two just talk, feeling each other out, his anger at his absent father and grief for his late mother, her dismay at her profession by necessity, yet being too proud to return home to Georgia in shame, are amazing. There's so much wonderful subtlety that conveys so much. For instance, he mentions his mother taught music. Several scenes later, he's playing virtuoso-level piano in the hotel ballroom for the catering staff, revealing just how deep his relationship with his mother was. The dialogue and jokes are snappy even today, decades later. It avoids being schmaltzy by being earnest. An amazing cast of character actors. Every single role elevates the whole. A huge argument for Oscar for Best Ensemble Cast. Roberts, in particular, earns every single ounce of her Best Actress nomination. The character Vivian is fallen but not beaten. She retains her dreams, though she knows not yet how to attain them. Had she never acted again, we would all still remember her. Second chances exist. Experiencing true love makes you a better person. The best rom-com ever. Fight me! This romance is my favorite. Wow, very nicely put.
That was Adam?
Yep.
Just once. I wish he'd have a specific focused opinion, wouldn't you?
I know. It's so vague and all over the place.
Just kidding. Thank you,
very
Adam.
Very nice one, Adam.
I actually have never seen that film. Have you?
Yeah, I have, and he's right. It should be schmaltzy. It's a fairy tale. It's a nice fairy tale.
Yeah.
Jamie Kleinert, speaking of fairy tales, says, Ever After. Bzz, bzz. I sneezed in my cocaine.
I think the king floated an air biscuit.
Yep, sappy sentimentality and cheese times 100,000. But at the same time, Cinderella is a force majeure and has a brilliant mind of her own. She's well-read and puts Prince Charming in his place a time or two or five throughout the movie. She's not just a trophy beauty. She's got a mind to contend with. A mind and a brain, sorry. And that's such an improvement on the trope that I love it. There's a level of intellectual engagement between the two I absolutely love and don't find many other places. The other one I love is Dangerous Beauty. Although it's not a traditional romance because it's more about love that was forbidden and rejected. Again, strong and intelligent woman character who is more than just a pretty, pretty prize and has formidable ambition and drive and skills. Wow.
Oh, cheese. Cool. I just love cheese. Rarely I do.
Dave says, it is odd to me that a story about two ordinary people who lead ordinary lives and fall in love seemingly isn't enough to make an interesting movie.
And yet?
There are lots of movies that include some subplot about love or message about love, but it's hard to find a love story that is not jazzed up with some level of action or comedy.
It's true.
I remember liking Somewhere in Time a lot. Oh, wow. That was that...
H.G. Wells film?
No. That's the Christopher Reeves, Jane Seymour time travel one. But no idea how it would stand up. On the Japan side, the girl who traveled through time seems to make the lists of best romantic movies, and I enjoyed that one. I don't know that one. Though it was remade, and I have not seen the remake. It's also a good companion to Somewhere in Time, since both are jazzed up by time travel. For a movie that is a straightforward love story, Pride and Prejudice also comes to mind. Interesting, but which version? There have been like 9.
Yeah. It's like A Star is Born.
He also adds, my better half recommends the Before Sunset trilogy, which is indeed just about two people meeting and falling in love. A lot of talking, but those are nice too. Never seen those, any of them.
Me either. Thanks, Dave.
Tim Potter puts another vote in for Somewhere in Time with Christopher Reeve and Jane Seymour. Not a big fan of romance movies, but this one was a wonderful fantasy that just melts your heart. Dr. Professor Rebecca Peltke says, Some Kind of Wonderful from the 80s. Oh, yeah. Only Lovers Left Alive. Oh. Tom Hiddleston and Tilda Swinton are as moody vampires in a long-term relationship.
Oh, my.
Yeah, that was a movie that confused me.
Matchbooks confuse Max, so.
Well, yes. No, I mean, Like, Tom Hiddleston is walking around wearing nothing but a pair of leather pants, and suddenly I'm feeling funny.
Max is straight.
Yeah! Also says, Sense and Sensibility, mostly for Alan Rickman. That's fair.
Yeah.
Roland, the headless Thompson Gunner Hardy,
no.
says, Prince of Tides, a little neurotic, romantic, drama, nice soundtrack.
No, man, the loons!
That is not Prince of Tides at all.
I'm pretty sure it is. There's water in that film,
You're
right?
Completely wrong. No, there are very little tides. Yeah.
Oh.
Charles Forsyth says, I would go for Harold and Maude.
Oh.
But I'm not sure that's a contrarian romance as much as it's a contrarian male manic pixie dream girl movie, or manic pixie septuagenarian movie, I guess.
Magic pixie grandma?
Perhaps this is a bit pedestrian, but I really love Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Oh.
It hits a lot of notes really well, but most importantly, it doesn't feature people acting in inexplicable ways. A lot of romance movie plots are driven by something stupid, like a misunderstanding that could be cleared up if either party just initiated a conversation.
Hmm. Neat.
Richard, I invented the Tatum.
There is no such thing.
the farmer and his wife in Sunrise. Oh, wow. That's an old silent film.
Oh.
They start torn apart but find each other again by the end, and it makes me cry every single time. Ursula Murray Husted says, oh, gosh, John Carey's Once is a perfect romantic movie. I cry buckets every time.
Oh.
I don't know that one. I don't either. Think. Once.
Hmm. Well, we know what the sequel's called.
Once again, or once more.
I was thinking twice, but...
yeah. Meredith Gilchrist says, I apologize for giving the same answer as a previous question, but La La Land.
Huh.
The twist...
I think she meant Moonlight.
Yeah, that's right. Nope, sorry, she meant Moonlight. The twist away from the expected couple and the wistful embracing of the bittersweet way things worked out at the end breaks my heart every time. Okay. And for the expert in all things romantic to melt the frozen heart of the North, we have Vince. Says, I want to avoid other tragic love stories for my favorite, so I'm going with Le Fabuleux Destin d'Amélie Poulain, or as we learned it here, Amélie.
Oh.
Where a true oddball character does truly bizarre things to get the attention of a boy she fancies, and he isn't any less an oddball in the end. The film is fantastic, funny, and at the end I felt my heart grew three sizes that day. You're a mean one, Mr. Vince. The lead, Audrey Tautou, was in another film by the same director, Un Long Dimanche de Fiancées,
It means the Long March of the Fiancées, that's what it means.
Yeah, it does not. Which is also quite the love story, but deals with some pretty serious stuff, as a girl with consequences from polio during World War I is told her fiancé has been killed, but instead finds him. I won't spoil it, but it's a sad yet somehow hopeful film with a scene so horrifying in the trenches, no one I saw the film with slept well for days after seeing it. Well, there's a recommendation.
Consequences. As long as I'm rich.
But those are all terrific. Mike, what's your favorite filmic love story?
It's not really a love story, but it's just after going through so much, there's just this measure of hope. It's the end of Moonlight where Mahershala Ali's character Juan is finally, seemingly allowing himself to potentially start in a relationship. And if you have not seen Moonlight, it is a rough film. Ali is, I haven't seen anything that Ali's been in that he hasn't been awesome. I really want to see more of him. And as a gay person, all right, I'll put it right out there. Us gay people, we love our drama. Oh, do we love our drama. But...
Racist?
Huh?
Never mind.
But it's... What he's going through in that movie is still very true. And it's harder in some communities than others, and it really did deserve its Best Picture win. I didn't see La La Land, but yeah, whatever.
I did, and I'm pretty sure Moonlight deserved it more.
Yeah. The other one I'm going to go with is Richard Blaine and Louis from Casablanca.
Because they are an adorable couple.
Aren't they?
Yes, they are. They really should have been the ones to end. They do end up together, technically.
They do. Yeah. I know. It's a beautiful friendship. It's not gay, blah, blah, blah.
Well, that's how it all starts.
Yeah. Other than that, I don't know. For if I was having to pick something real, I actually am really, really taken in, and it's a guilty pleasure film, and I'm pretty sure we covered this, by the two main characters in Notting Hill.
Oh, sure. Oh, that's adorable. Julia Roberts and Hugh Grant. And Julia Roberts. They're adorable.
Because his character's nickname of Flopsy is so perfect. He is. Let's face it, Hugh Grant, very Flopsy.
He is.
And I think a lot of us have a sort of secret wish to, like, oh, what if a movie star or somebody really important and famous liked me? And, you know, it's sappy. It's got a great... I don't even like Elvis Costello, but it has a couple of great songs in there by Elvis Costello. It's got a great performance by what's-his-name is Spike, who would later become Xenophilia's Lovegood.
Reese Ifans, yep. He's awesome.
So maybe those are mine favorites at today. Anyway. Okay. How about you, Max? Who do you love to see, love again?
Well, loving lovers love. I think Bogey and Bacall, I just love in anything, pretty much. They really were adorable. But more recently, I have to say Martin and Debbie from Gross Point Blank, you know, John Cusack and Minnie Driver. They don't make any sense in a lot of ways, and it doesn't make sense that they end up together, but their chemistry is so good, and they're just so darn adorable whenever they talk.
Huh. Neat.
Yeah, so those were all terrific.
They were.
Answers, thank you so much. Yes, and very fulsomely explained in many cases.
Oh, you said fulsome. Oh,
yes, and of course, your reward for doing hard work is more hard work.
Yeah,
and the new question, what is your favorite theme song or main song from a non-musical movie?
Oh.
Yeah.
Like hit single theme song? Or?
Yeah, like, you know, Morning After from Poseidon Adventure.
That was a big hit.
Any of the James Bond theme songs, sure. You know.
Neat.
And at the end, we will reveal to you the deep, dark secret of how you can tell us. And before we get to trivia, I would like to mention that today's show is being sponsored by our brand new sponsor, Maison de Velour.
What?
Makers of fine French wine.
Fine?
It treats your friends to a European vacation without ever leaving home.
Not if you want to
Maison
keep them.
De Velour.
It tastes like socks.
The finest wine from Idaho.
Make wine in Idaho. I didn't approve this. How much are they giving us?
Nothing. We love the product so much, Mike.
No, we don't. Hey, let go.
No. Shush.
Maison de poop. That's what it should be called.
Quiet, you. I'm not sending this check back.
It's as French as French dressing, Maison de Velour. I like to velour you. Wink.
Anyway, so trivia. The facts. One of the myths about this movie was that it was not financially successful. That's not true. On a budget of $2.7 million. And that's 1939 money.
That's a lot of money.
It made a lot of money. It made $25 million.
And that's all it ever made ever.
Ever. And it has made so much more since in every possible way.
Yeah.
A recent study claims, and again, this is only one study, I'm sure someone could contradict it, that this is the single most watched movie in film history.
Wow.
Due to the number of television screenings each year, as well as all the various video, DVD, Blu-ray, 4K releases, which have enabled children of every generation to see it. MGM paid $75,000 for the film rights to L. Frank Baum's book, which at the time, that's a crap ton of money for a script.
He wasn't even alive by then. I think he was dead by then.
He was. This was to his family.
Ah.
This is not the first filmed version of The Wizard of Oz.
No.
Sort of. Well, there was a silent version in 1925. If you didn't see it, you're not alone. It barely got any release, and it bankrupted the studio that produced it, the Chadwick Pictures, which I'm sure we all remember, and it virtually killed Larry Seaman, the writer, director, and actor who played the Scarecrow.
Oh.
The plot has almost nothing to do with the original book, but does use some material from one of the later books, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz.
Oh.
Oliver Hardy plays the Tin Man.
Oh.
Yeah.
Must have been before he was Oliver Hardy.
No, not really. This was probably right around the peak of, I think it was when he was trying to make it on his own.
I've seen clips of it. It's it bears a resemblance to a school stage play, really.
Yeah, pretty much. The director, of course, was a Victor Fleming. Well, he was not the original choice of the director. The first director was a guy named Richard Thorpe, who was fired after 2 weeks.
I was going to say, he was. There's more than one director on this film.
Oh, yes. Thorpe, well, I'll get to him. The other director, there's another one, a guy named King Vidor.
Oh, yeah.
He actually directed most of the Kansas scenes, and he is not credited in the movie at his request.
Oh.
They offered him credit, but he said, no, this is all Fleming.
Oh.
I don't put my name on it.
Hmm.
When the film first started, Richard Thorpe decided, you know what would be good for Judy Garland? A blonde wig.
Yeah.
And heavy baby doll makeup, and we're going to make her like 18.
Yeah.
When George Cukor took over as an interim director, he basically said, take off the wig, take off the makeup, just be yourself.
Hmm.
Good choice.
Yeah.
The Munchkins are portrayed, as it says in the credits, by the Singer Midgets.
Yeah.
That's not named for their musical ability,
no,
but for their manager, Leo Singer. The troupe came over from Europe. Many of them were Jewish, and a number of them took advantage of the trip to say, hi, can we stay here and not go get put in the gas chamber?
Yeah, good for them.
Most of their voices are dubbed, as many of the little folk couldn't speak English or sing very well.
Most?
Only two of them are actually, do you actually hear them, their real voices, and they're the ones who give Dorothy the flowers after she climbed into the carriage. You know, we thank you very sweetly.
Ah, still sped up, though.
Yeah. The famous Surrender Dorothy skywriting scene was done using a tank of water and a tiny model witch attached to the end of a hypodermic needle. The syringe was filled with milk, the tip of the needle was put in the tank, and the words were written in reverse while being filmed from below. There was an added phrase, by the way, after Surrender Dorothy was supposed to say, or die, but they cut it as one of the many scenes they thought was too scary for kids. The tornado was a 35-foot-long muslin stocking spun around among miniatures of a Kansas farm and fields in a dusty atmosphere.
I love that effect.
It's an amazing effect. This movie has no fewer than three, count them, three, of the 100 greatest movie lines listed by Premier Magazine in 2007. You know what they are. There's no place like home. Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore. And pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Judy Garland, by the way, this is a section. This movie was very dangerous to a number of people and caused much harm to the cast. Judy Garland had to wear a painful corset device around her torso so that she'd appear younger and flat-chested, because she was 16 at the time, and she was playing a pre-adolescent child.
And how shall we put this? Not flat-chested.
Yeah. And the ruby slippers were so uncomfortable, she would only wear them in scenes where they were visible. You can actually see in Munchkinland, she's wearing dance shoes at one point.
Ah.
During the Haunted Forest sequence, several of the actors playing the Winged Monkeys fell off the piano wires suspending them and dropped several feet to the stage.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
But flying monkeys is funny.
Yeah. I mean, now we all know Ray Bolger was originally cast as the Tin Man, but he insisted he wanted to be the Scarecrow. Buddy Ebsen, as we all know, was cast as the Scarecrow and then switched roles with Bolger. Unbeknownst to him, the makeup of the Tin Man contained aluminum dust, which we now know is toxic, applied to the skin, which ended up coating Ebsen's lungs. He also had an allergic reaction to it. One day he just couldn't breathe, and they recast him.
Yeah.
They gave no public reason why.
But that's why.
By the way, if you listen, Buddy Ebsen is technically in the movie. His vocals are still there. Whenever they sing, "We're off to see the wizard," it's not Jack Haley's voice, it's Buddy Ebsen.
Oh. Jed himself, calling for Granny in the wilderness.
Exactly. In the famous poppy field scene, you know, poppies will make them sleep. The snow that they're dumping on them, that is industrial grade chrysotile asbestos.
Oh, dear.
Yes. even though they already knew asbestos was dangerous.
The sad thing is, it's some of the best looking fake snow
I've ever really seen. Is.
Oh dear, that's terrible.
Yeah. Bert Lahr's costume weighed 90 pounds.
90 pounds.
It was made from a real lion skin and very hot.
Oh.
The arc lights used to light the set often raised the temperature to over 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
Cripes.
Lahr would sweat so profusely that the costume would be soaked by the end of the day.
Yeah.
There were two people whose only job was to spend the night drying it out for the next day.
I bet that
smells. It was dry cleaned occasionally, but usually, in the words of one of the crew members, it reeked.
Awesome. Movie magic.
Yeah. Yep. In the first take of the scene when the Wicked Witch of the West leaves Munchkin Land, the smoke that was supposed to go up around her came early and started forming before she stepped on the platform she was supposed to be on. So they did a second take. When she did that, her cape caught on the platform right when the fire burst appeared. Her makeup heated up, causing second and third degree burns on her hands and face. It was later discovered one of the key components of the makeup was copper powder, which is flammable.
Oops.
The producers used the first take. You notice the early appearance of the red smoke.
If you look for it, yeah.
Yeah. Throughout the rest of his career, Jack Haley, the Tin Man, denounced the idea that making the film was fun. Quote, "People question me like you're questioning me now, say, must have been a fun making The Wizard of Oz. It was not fun. Like hell it was fun. It was a lot of hard work. It was not fun at all." So, thanks, Jack.
Yeah.
In the song, If I Only Had a Heart,
yeah, which, we'll by come the back way, to that.
Yeah, Jack Haley is a Boston boy.
Oh, he's not the only one.
Yep. There's a little bird that sings, "Wherefore art thou, Romeo?"
Boom, boom.
The voice of that bird is Adriana Caselotti, the voice of Snow White from Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. She was paid $1,000 for that one line.
Wow. That's a nice job.
Mm-hmm. There is so much else. There's the hanging Munchkin myths. There's the other stuff with the flying monkeys. There's a ton.
There's no hanging. It's a bird.
That is a myth.
It's a heron. You can see it's a heron.
It's a crane, actually. A bird. A crane.
Yeah. Scary bird, though. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah. But what about you, Mike? You got any other tidbits?
I have a couple. Yeah. I mean, this film. Oh, dear gods. We could do an entire episode just on the trivia. But one of the things, it became fairly well known, I want to say starting in the 90s, and that there's an entire song that was filmed and cut out. And there's a little hint of what was supposed to happen, very little hint, still in the film, when the witch says, I've sent some insects ahead to take the fight out of them.
The Jitterbugs.
There's a song called The Jitterbug, which is entirely recorded. You can hear it. And they have some footage that somebody behind the scenes was just shooting at the time. So they've kind of married it together. And it really breaks the mood. It is a fun, happy, upbeat song in the middle of the haunted forest. Makes no sense at all.
It's also, I know they removed it because it dates the film too much. The Jitterbug was a very specific time frame.
It looks like it was hell to film because all the characters are having to basically do the jitterbug, basically.
Yeah.
And it just looks really tiring. The other, and this I did not know until looking up for stuff for the show, is that there was a reprise of Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Yes, I read about that. And I left that out.
That was recorded too, and you can hear it. And there's people who've like added footage to like say it might have looked something like this. But it's very sad, and it does have a verse that was not in the original song, not in the opening song. But it was supposed to take place after she gets locked in the tower and before her friends come and rescue her. And it's I think maybe a little too much. It's sort of like the or die part.
I read about that song. Apparently, she couldn't get through it without crying, and neither could the entire crew.
Yeah, and she does cry through it. So there's some editing choices. There was an elongated version of the Scarecrow's dance when she first meets him too, which is that you can find the full footage of that. Doesn't add anything. It's just more. So
no, I think they made good choices.
But other than that, again, there's tons of stuff. Mm-hmm. But there's one thing that people don't know.
What's that?
The plot. So would you tell us?
Oh, yeah. Nobody knows the plot to The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
All right. No, I'll tell you the real plot.
Oh, dear.
A dangerous psychotic named Dorothy Gale lives with her uncle and aunt in Kansas, presumably because her parents met with an accident. Here, she repeatedly tries to get her savage dog to murder a poor old spinster next door. When that fails, she sets off in search of fresh victims, only to be emotionally blackmailed by a traveling con man into heading home right into the path of a tornado. Accidentally, of course. Scooped up by the tornado, Dorothy then finds herself in a mysterious magical land, and the first thing she does is murder another lonely old woman by dropping her house on her. After the residents fall victim to Stockholm syndrome and believe she's their savior, she is sent to the capital city, no doubt to seize power from the current ruler.
You are horrible.
Along the way, she recruits a mob of easily led flunkies. One is too stupid to know any better. One has no heart, clearly a sociopath, and joins eagerly. And one is so terrified of this corn-fed demon that he has no choice but to obey. After pausing for an opium frolic in a field, the quartet storm the Emerald City, interrupt the leader, who is no doubt busy with civic obligations, and demand tribute, literally demanding hearts and minds, huh? Thinking quickly, the wizard king of the city distracts the girl with talk of an unmurdered old lady nearby. Dorothy can't stand the thought of an old woman not being murdered, so she cuts a bloody swath through the countryside and finally dissolves the poor Wicked Witch of the West into a screaming puddle of agony. Upon Dorothy's return, the wizard quite understandably flees the city, leaving his people to face Dorothy's wrath. Fortunately, Glinda, the good witch, shows up to reveal that Dorothy has been her unwitting cat's paw in the destruction of a rival witch, and Dorothy could have gone home at any time. Dorothy is not angry about this, no doubt because it gave her a chance to briefly quench her lust for senior citizen murder, and returns home. But a twist occurs. The whole adventure has been a psychotic fever dream, and Dorothy is safe at home, ready to unleash hell upon an unsuspecting Kansas. The end. The film.
I am going to fire you like I have never fired you before. You are so fired. But that you bring this up brings up a little piece that that my partner handed to me. He said, did you realize at one point, it was in 1998, somebody was writing the blurb in a newspaper for Inquirer Television. Mm-hmm. And of course, everyone knows the plot of The Wizard of Oz, so he decided to have a little fun, and apparently it's still going around the internet. So this is from a writer, Rick Polito, who, when asked to write the blurb for this film showing up on TCM, wrote, "Transported to a surreal landscape, a young girl kills the first person she meets, then teams up with three strangers to kill again."
See? I was right.
You are so horrible.
My interpretation is the correct one.
You are so horrible.
Hey, come on. This is basically what they're doing with Wicked.
Wow, boy, we've gone through a lot of time already. Let's go quickly through the actors. I don't think we're going to have a lot of problems here, but Judy Garland, okay.
Oh, wow.
I mean,
can you imagine they tried to get Shirley Temple to do this part?
It would just be a very different film.
It would be a very different film. Also, I'm sorry, Shirley Temple could sing, she could dance, she was not that great an actor.
Well, she can't sing like this. My note was, her voice sounds like velvety syrup. That next to last note in Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Well, you've messed me up with your horrible recap of the plot.
Accurate.
When she got that last cant where she just bends it is just, oh my God, it's so perfect.
It's so gorgeous. You know, one thing I noticed, this is going ahead of it, in this that I hadn't thought about for a long time is how seamlessly they move from spoken dialogue to singing.
Yeah, you don't.
Especially her. There's no musical buildup. It's just suddenly it's somewhere over. Oh, wow. And it works so well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Judy Garland is wonderful in this. She emotes so well. She's so instantly likable.
The one thing I will say about the character of Dorothy Gale, does not belong on that farm. She stands out like a sore thumb, but we'll come back to the story in a little bit.
Yeah, she's amazing. She can fall into a pig pen and get out without a drop of dirt on her anywhere.
Yeah. The rest of the little crew there. So Ray Bolger. I don't know him really from anything else, but I can't imagine anybody else playing this part.
World-class dancer, that man.
Yeah.
Great dancer. Jack Haley is a great dancer.
Well,
Burt Lahr is not.
No.
That's why they don't try to make him dance.
Ray Bolger is our other Bostonian, and he he's not quite as flagrant in his accent as Jack Haley, who's not, he's not trying to hide anything. No, he's got a hot. He wants a hot. It's like, okay.
Yes, well, Ray Bolger wants to be wicked smart.
Yeah, pretty much. Jack Haley, you know, Buddy Ebsen,
I would have liked to see Buddy Ebsen do it. I think he could have done it.
I don't know.
He was very good at likable.
I got to say this though, and I had to look this up just in case. Jack Haley as the Tin Man?
Mm-hmm.
Gay.
Oh,
very,
okay.
Very gay. He is very, very gay. Yes, that's one of my...
So he literally was a friend of Dorothy.
He was not gay in actual real life, but I need a hot. He's just so soft
People point out that he... If you listen to his character, Hickory, his voice is much deeper. He pitches it much higher intentionally for the Tin Man.
But for the prize for gayest in this film has to go to Burt Lahr as the Lion.
He's just over the top. He's so much fun. It's like Ray Bolger starts out as, hi, I'm the comic relief. I'm the funny one. And Burt Lahr is like, that's cute. Hold my beer.
He uses the word sissy and dandelion, and he's got a bow in his hair, and he's just like the fayest thing in the entire film. That being said, he kind of steals the film from the other two. Ray Bolger is great in his dance and his acting, and Jack Haley, you're just sitting there going, how does he do that in that horrible costume? But let's face it, the funny man of the three is definitely Burt Lahr. And again, I don't know any of these three from anything else, but...
I listened to a recording of Burt Lahr in Waiting for Godot as, I believe, Estragon, and he friggin' nailed it.
Wow. They're all a lot of fun. I think, however, one of the best actors in the film is Frank Morgan.
Frank Morgan, who's actually four different characters, well, five if you count Professor Marvel.
Yeah.
He's four characters in the Emerald City sequentially. You know, he's the door warden, he's the cab driver who's doing a Dick Van Dyke-esque Cockney accent.
Sure.
He's the soldier at the guard who guards the Palace of Oz, and he's Oz.
But he's got this wonderful way of saying these grandiose things and then adding things under his breath that you don't notice so much. I found him incredibly charming. I haven't seen this before, but I really like the way he delivers things in that little asides, his little asides.
It really is something. His verbal dexterity is so good. Even just the little things when he's insulting them, when they first meet him, he says, calls the Tin Man, you clinking, clanking, clattering collection of collisionous junk.
Well, he obviously stole that from Jonathan Harris on Lost in Space.
Dr. Smith, which there, of course, you bubble-headed booby.
Which, of course, wouldn't happen for almost 30 more years, but that, details.
he is so much fun.
Yeah. Billy Burke as Glinda is fine.
Oh, I like her. She seems very, you know, in otherworldly with that little girly voice. And
she seems just so, I don't know, petite and pretty and effectual until she waves her wand and says, be gone before someone drops a house on you. It's like,
And the Wicked Witch is like, Lars looking around, going, what? Is there another house? What?
And when she sings, her voice can nearly shatter glass. I mean,
it's very high pitched.
Yeah. And she's fun. Don't get me wrong.
She is fun.
But let's face it.
Margaret Hamilton.
The Wicked Witch of all Wicked Witches.
She was so good. Another thing I left out of the trivia is Judy Garland had a lot of trouble acting afraid of Margaret Hamilton because apparently Margaret Hamilton was so nice to her and was an absolute sweetheart. When Louis B. Mayer wouldn't let Judy Garland go on a school trip because it would interfere with shooting, Hamilton called up Louis B. Mayer, the most powerful man in Hollywood, and bitched him out over the phone.
You mean witched him out?
Yes.
But let's face it, I want to say pretty much after this film, if there is a witch character of some sort, it is based on this performance, and she gives it her all. She just like throws herself in, and she's quite honestly wonderfully wicked. She's awesome. We've got Uncle Henry and Aunt Em, which are fine.
They're fine.
I do have to wonder, why are they so old?
Well, I guess Dorothy's mother or father, whoever was related to whichever of them they were related to, must have been a lot younger. Maybe a little accident there, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I guess. The last one I have to mention anyway is the best trained dog I have ever seen, and that is
Toto's
Terry.
Amazing. Terry the Terrier. Yep.
He seems to really love her. The story I heard, which I don't think is true, was that she kept a piece of liver in her shoe. But quite honestly, all throughout the film, Judy Garland is grabbing animals. She's constantly grabbing Toto. She grabs chicks. She goes after, she's like grabbing them. But that dog seems to adore her, and he's everywhere he needs to be, doing exactly what he needs to do. And dogs will usually upstage actors and stuff, and he doesn't.
No, he's part of it.
Yeah, I'm giving a lot of credit to Terry. I hate the fact that they list them as either the Munchkins, because that's why they show up in the beginning of the film, or the Singer Midgets. And I would like to dispel, there was a horrible appearance by Judy Garland, I think on Jack Parr at one point, where she was talking about how much they were all drunks and rowdy and stuff, and they weren't. The drunks. Now, I don't think she was at the time, but apparently they were all perfectly fine.
Her difficulty started when she was young, because as she was growing, her weight kept fluctuating. So the studio goes, I see, have some amphetamines.
So, rough spot, not treated probably very well by Hollywood. Although, from your story, I'm really glad that it meant an exit for a bunch of people that otherwise might have been caught and killed.
Yeah.
So, it's one of those casts. You really can't imagine anybody else in any of the roles, really any of them. So, but the story.
Okay, let's just get this out of the way. Dennis Miller pointed this out.
Yeah.
It's like, at the end, when Glinda says, oh, you've had the power to go home all along. Because he says, I've always wanted Dorothy to just slap the bleep out of her at this point. You had the power to tell me this 3 hours ago. Did I need this drug trip? One minute I'm washing clothes in Kansas. Next minute a tree's chasing me down the road. I want a ticket out of here now.
And if you don't do it, I'm going to start throwing you out to the midgets. Yeah, that's Dennis, Dennis Miller, so yeah.
Yeah.
There's a couple of things towards the end of the film in particular that didn't, I guess she's supposed to learn a lesson. The problem is the lesson she learns does not make any sense, at least not to me. Basically, it's like, never go traveling, never go looking for anything that's beyond the gate of your home. And it's like,
now that's possible. But the other thing I think the message is, and it also is reinforced by all three of her friends, is it's about realizing what you already have. As the song says, Oz didn't give nothing to the Tin Man that he didn't already have.
Yeah.
The Scarecrow is already smart. The Tin Man already loves, and when the chips are down, the Lion shows real courage. They just don't realize they have these things. And I think it's the idea that Dorothy doesn't realize how good, what the wonderful thing she has at home. She has a loving family, and I'm done, because she's in the middle of a friggin' dust bowl.
And again, I don't think the character fits with the other characters. Like, there's just something, there's a glow about Judy Garland that...
Well, she's so clean.
Well, there's that, too. I mean, she's the only one who's wearing clothes that actually fit her. And even when she's in black and white, there's kind of a color about her, so... The idea that you shouldn't look for your heart's desire beyond your own front door. Even as a kid, I was like, wait, what?
No. Yeah, that's a weird message, although you can kind of see it coming. This is coming out of the Great Depression.
Well,
more just about to go into World War II.
Well, and there was a lot of people saying we shouldn't get involved. And
yeah, especially stay home, don't go anywhere, everything you need is right here, be an isolationist.
Could this be like a little statement from Hollywood? Don't know. I don't know enough about the politics of the time to know if that was... Because I know there was a lot of resistance, and of course we wouldn't enter the war for another 2 years. But it could be. It's just, even as a kid, I was just like, what, I should never go anywhere and see anything? No. If anything, a lot of times travel will help you appreciate what you have at home, but that's fine.
Yeah, so there is that. There are also little weird things, like they have guns in Oz.
Who had guns?
Oh, that's right. The Scarecrow's carrying a pistol when they're in the haunted forest.
It's the only one, but yeah. Yeah,
but they means they have an ammunition manufacturing plant somewhere.
Well, they
because that's a revolver. They've got cartridge ammunition. Yeah, I know. This is like it's a kid's movie. I still don't know why he was carrying a huge bug sprayer.
Well, that was a witch neutralizer or whatever it was. Yeah,
something like that.
I will say this as a child, because you know we used to. For those who don't somehow know, back in the dawn of time when we used to have to watch movies on TV, this would show up once a year, and I think it was CBS, and they had license.
Big deal.
And every year, it's like this is your one chance to watch The Wizard of Oz. And as kids, we all did our best to be home to watch it, and it probably held some record for a long time for viewership. And I remember one year, and I think it was around this time of year. I think it was near to Easter. It was sometime in the spring. I remember we were visiting my grandmother, and I was in the backseat of the car going, hurry up, get home. I want to see The Wizard of Oz. I want to see The Wizard of Oz. And we were halfway through the film before we got home. But it was a big deal. Also, as a kid, though, you don't realize how heavily they lay on that foreshadowing. Oh, dear. You know, all the things the characters say when they're in the farmyard, and
someday they're going to put up a statue to me.
Yeah, don't start posing for it now.
Yeah, you think you don't have any brains or anything. Yeah, and little things that you don't always notice, like when the witch is taking Toto away to drown him, the basket she stuffs him in is the same one she uses as Miss Gulch.
Yeah. Well, and of course, that's not part of the original plot. The idea that Oz is a dream world that is caused by
cerebral hemorrhage. No, in the book, it's a real place. It's an actual place.
Yeah. There's this one little line that M gets to say that I've always liked, where she basically wants, what she wants to say, I'm going to have to beep this, and I do the sound ending, so I don't care. But when she comes and takes Toto and basically is taking him to be shot, because in these days, that's probably all they have.
Yeah.
M finally gives up and wants to say, you know what? You and she doesn't,
but
she
says, as a Christian woman, I can't say it.
But you know that that's what she wants to say,
yeah.
And then she meets Marvel, and I think Professor Marvel is wonderful. That tornado effect, I gotta say, I've seen footage of what it looked like just like on the stage, and you'd like this wouldn't fool anybody. And I'm watching this print, and I want to get to the print in a sec, and that tornado still looks freaking fantastic,
it really does. It's amazing.
The dust flying up everything, I buy it. It was really noisy. I saw the footage was sound, and it's like chugga 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 chugga. Speaking of the print, so
yeah,
they have redone the print. There's been a big 4K remaster. I think they do one every 10 years, whatever.
Yeah.
For me, it looked fantastic, and they fixed one of the things that it's always bugged me as a kid. When that last shot just before Dorothy opens the door when she's landed in Oz, you can tell the shade of the film has already shifted. It's not sepia tone, it's black and white, except it's not. It's just lit such that there's no color showing through. And it's never worked. And this time, they color matched it, and it was wonderful. And it's like, no change at all. So it really is a little bit more magical of an effect. But
I mean, it's beautiful to look at, but I do have to say, you look at Margaret Hamilton's makeup in the close-ups, and you go, oh, it's not even.
And to be fair, I don't know if that's an issue with the makeup or an issue with the you know, polishing.
Maybe it was supposed to be like that. Maybe it was supposed to look blotchy. I don't know.
Well, who knows if it has anything to do with the burns, right?
That too.
Yeah.
They might just, under her eyes, they might not have been able to put the makeup on anymore.
Yeah, the green I thought was, I forgot how vivid an emerald of green that was. That was wonderful. Yeah, but it was supposed to be a big deal because there was barely any color photography at all by 39. And this and that other film that came out this year did color, and they did it in a big way because, you know, if we're going to do this and we're going to spend the money, which they did, we're going to go big and go home in this case. So I think if you haven't seen it in a while, if you haven't seen one of the big 4K restos, then by all means rent it or, you know, purchase it, whatever you want to do. Or if it's streaming, I guess you saw it streaming. It looks fantastic. And
it does. And it sounds beautiful.
It does.
I mean, the songs in this, they're all winners, really.
Yeah.
There are no bad songs.
No,
there are songs that are better than others, but
I mean, somewhere over there, it still hits me every time.
Yeah.
Although it's always Max who cries.
Shut up, you're crying.
No, you're crying. Stupid. I do have a couple questions, though. Maybe you can help answer them. Does it seem to you like the Munchkins probably don't get much work done?
I don't see how they could, and neither do the people in the Emerald City. They tell us what their work schedule is.
Yeah.
They get up at 12 and start to work at 1. They take an hour for lunch, and then at 2, they're done.
Yeah.
So they don't do anything.
No.
How does anything get done in this city? It doesn't make sense.
They seem to have a lot of fun doing it, I guess.
They're all very chipper.
Yeah, don't see any.
And they look like they have enough to eat, so I guess it's all magic. Yeah. I don't know.
But this other question is a question I've had since I was a kid, and I'm dying to know, and I don't think it's ever addressed anywhere because I think it only exists in the movie. And where does the Red Brick Road go?
I'm assuming that goes to the land of the Gillikins.
There's no Gillikins in this film.
I know, there's no Gillikins.
Gillikin,
there's
drop that coconut!
Bonk!
Ow!
There's no Gillikins, there's no Quadlings, and there's no Winkies.
Technically, the Winkies are the ones with the Wicked Witch of the West.
I guess.
Except they don't say it, but those are technically
the Winkies. Well, they didn't do the whole Frank Baum color scheme where each kingdom had one color.
I'm kind of glad
because that would get kind of old to watch.
Yeah, but it's like, where does that go? It goes somewhere. I want to know.
Also, the thing it didn't occur to me, I think until this viewing, when Dorothy meets the Scarecrow, the yellow brick road goes into three different directions. Yeah. Neither of them know which is the right one, but they just pick one, and it appears to be the right one. How did they know?
Well, the Scarecrow's the one who points, so maybe he did know. Maybe the person who made him...
He points at two different routes.
No. At the end, when they're dancing and they're getting ready to go, he points, and that's the way they go. So I don't know. Who cares?
I think it's problematic, but...
One of my favorite lines in this film is... It's a tiny little line, doesn't go anywhere. It's when they first come across the Tin Man, and he can barely talk, and he's saying something. He said, oil can. Oil can what?
I still like, they took my legs and they threw them over there. They took my chest and they threw it over there. Well, that's you all over. The dialogue in this can be really funny and very touching. One of the things I like about Dorothy, she's so polite.
Yeah.
She always, how do you do? She gives a little curtsy, which admittedly for 1939 is a little weird.
Right before she makes her demands.
Yes.
She kind of demands from everybody.
Kinda. I mean, they're going to the wizard. You're like, oh, wow, the wizard's being really mean. They're just these strangers come and say, hi. Give us these things.
Hey, Moon, gimme. Yeah. And he's like, actually, of course, what does he do? He's like, I don't want to deal with you. Here, go do this thing that'll probably get you all killed.
Yeah, I'm sending you on a suicide mission. Oh, you came back. Crap.
Very, very much don't want anybody to find out that I'm a word nobody uses anymore. I'm a humbug, but there you go.
Yeah, yep.
I also got to say, proof in the Land of Oz, very flimsy thing. Oh, you're the witch's Dorothy. Prove it. Well, she's wearing the ruby slippers.
I got the sparkly shoes.
That the good witch of the North gave her. Oh, so she is. Well, come on in. That makes sense. Sure.
It is a kid's movie. I know. You can't apply much logic to this.
I suppose. There's also a scene that has always worked for me, but of course, when we watch films for the show, we watch them more critically, and there's literally no reason for it to work. The witch says, fine, I'm going to kill you. You have this much time to live, turns the hourglass over, and leaves. What is the mechanism of Dorothy's death?
I don't know, except I think it's torturing her. I think it's like, and the anticipation. I think it's just an example of her being wicked.
Well,
except, but yes, I also don't understand. I this is the time I'm like, what do you mean this has to be done delicately? Why delicately? What do you have to do? Just hack her feet off or something.
You're horrible. But yeah, it's just like I always felt like she needed to get out of the room. Like something in the room was going to happen and then she was going to die. And as long as she's nowhere near the hourglass, she's okay, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think it goes back to...
I like some of her little lines, the stuff like, ring around the rosy, a pocket full of spears.
Yeah.
Like, whoa, where did that come from? And my only other logical question is, why does she leave a bucket of lethal water lying around?
Well, obviously, it was one of those stupid Winkies.
I guess so. Ooh, right in the Winky.
You know what I can't believe, really can't believe, is that we've already got to that time.
Yeah.
Where we have to decide,
so much to talk
do we
about
like
movie,
the film? Should it have won? And all that stuff. Yeah. So let's get to that part.
Yeah.
the finish.
So, Max.
Yeah.
Have you seen The Wizard of Oz?
You can't even get through that sentence. No. I've lost track of how many times. I've seen it in theaters. I've seen it on TVs. I've seen it all over the place. I've seen it on the back of my eyelids some nights. Yeah, many, many times. I love this friggin' movie.
Yeah.
This movie is one of the great movies. I think everyone should see it. I think it should be legally required.
Yeah. Here's the big question, because I know you've seen the film that won that year, which was Gone with the Wind. Which film do you think deserved Best Picture?
I don't know. Deserved is a weird way to put it, but I understand why Gone with the Wind won.
Mm.
Gone with the Wind covered up. First off, this is a children's movie.
Yeah.
Children's movies don't win these awards.
Nope.
They tend not to be as respected, for better or worse. That's just the way it happens. Second off, this movie had nobody in it.
No.
It had no big names. Judy Garland was just starting out, and the others were, you know, solid character actors, and, you know, they had done stuff, but they weren't famous. Gone with the Wind had friggin' Clark Gable, who was, at that point, one of the biggest movie stars alive. It had Vivian Leigh. It had Olivia de Havilland. And also, it was so much more epic and sweeping. And there is the minor point that while it had twice the budget that Wizard had, it had like its budget was $4 million. It made $250 million. To put that in perspective, I looked this up to 2024 dollars, that's over $4 billion. So, yeah. This movie was much more of an event.
Mm.
It was much more of a thing.
And it does have revivals, and it does get shown, but not nearly as much. It is not as beloved, I don't think.
I don't think so. I think it's respected, but I don't think it's as loved. And how many people are sitting there, I can't wait to show my kid Gone with the Wind.
Especially the racism.
Yeah.
So would you leave the Oscar where it is, or?
I'm afraid I would. I think of the two of them, Gone with the Wind was probably the more significant film.
Mm.
Hell, it changed the law that you could say the word damn in a movie.
Yeah, well, there's progress.
They actually took an act of Congress for that. The cinematography is astonishing. The performances are amazing. I think it's a close thing. And I have heard people say that name both these movies as the greatest movies ever made. And it's a close thing.
Mm.
In terms of significance, personal significance, I don't know. To me, I give the edge to Wizard of Oz. I can imagine not having seen Gone with the Wind. I cannot imagine never having seen Wizard of Oz.
Mm.
What about you? What do you think?
I used to watch this every year. I was excited to see it. It wasn't until I became a sullen teen that I stopped watching, and I probably even still watched it then if it was on.
But you watched it ironically.
Sure. I have seen it on a big screen. It was very embarrassing. I went with some of my friends, Steve and Tony Kellner, and they had Frank Avruch, a big Boston supposed celebrity.
Oh, no.
Yeah, he doesn't like to talk about that part. And they were doing this big presentation at the Wang Center, and they actually had one of the few surviving cast members who happened to be one of the little people who played a munchkin. And they're like, if you would stand up, and I am looking everywhere and I can't find this person, till Tony Kellner pokes me on the shoulder and said, Mike, she's right in front of you. Because, of course, she's a little person and I'm looking up because I'm an idiot. I have not seen this film in probably 20 years. Not actually sat through it and watched it. And there is an innocence of this film that you cannot capture today. You can't.
No.
There's no way you could, and there's no part of this film that is suggestive of anything else. If you bring stuff to it, that's you. You can make sexual comments. I made comments about the characters seeming gay. That's me. That is not the film. Dandelion, okay, maybe that, but. And, well, he does the hand thing, too. So.
Yeah.
But it is a moment of time that cannot ever come back. And I have to wonder, how does this film speak to how we have changed as a people in our postmodern, really cynical world?
Post-ironic.
Like, that's why this film can't be made. But people are still watching it. I would say that the average age has probably come down a bit, but... I think if you're alone and you can just watch it and not worry about what anybody around you thinks and not worrying about making jokes about stuff,
and not be embarrassed because you're singing along with all the songs.
Yeah, or crying at Somewhere Over the Rainbow, the actual original version.
How do you not cry at that?
It is still an astounding film. It was horribly difficult to make. It was ridiculously expensive. You know, it's just one of those things. Do I think it should have won the Best Picture? It honestly comes down to taste. I think if you like one film better than the other, then that's the one you think should win. I think they're both amazing achievements. I think one of them, like you said, has a much bigger cultural significance, but which is, from a filmmaking standpoint, which was the bigger tale, which was the bigger event? Because at the end of Wizard of Oz, they're basically telling you, nothing happened. She fell asleep. It's fine.
She got conked on the head. She probably has brain damage. It's adorable.
Yeah. So this is the toss-up. And, of course, it wasn't even Best Picture. It was a Most Astounding Picture or something like that. I forget. It wasn't even Best Picture then. So this one, I think we're going to have to come out as kind of a tie.
Yeah.
Which means we're not deciding anything, but too bad. You didn't pay us for it.
Yeah.
Not even Maison de Velour paid us for that.
Yes, we're going to pay you in cases of Maison de Velour.
You can purchase it now with your Bumpy Bucks. Trust me on that one. Each one of them is equally valid. Bumpy Bucks Maison de Velour. But you know what is valid is our poll question.
Yes, it is, which I'd like to know. What's your favorite theme song from a non-musical movie? By non-musical, I just mean a movie that is not a musical. Mm. You know, your favorite theme song. Morning After, Spy Who Loved Me.
The Flintstones.
I Love You, You Love Me.
No, there were no Barney movies.
Sure. And you can tell us this by going to our website, maxmikemovies.com, and leaving a comment. Or you can email us at us@maxmikemovies.com. Works out nicely that way. You can find us on the Facing Book. And under Max
Facebook,
Mike Movies.
Facebook.
And we are on many, many, many podcast apps.
Aren't we soon to be on a new one?
And soon we will be, I hope, on YouTube Music.
Ooh. Then we'll make our loads and loads of cash.
Yes. That's when the YouTube money comes a-flowing in.
As long as it doesn't flow like Maison de Velour.
We have just started this series of Didn't Win. What's next week's huge loser that we're watching?
Well, funny you should put it that way, because this film is, in a way, a huge loser. I'm sticking with old Hollywood, and it's a film that I'm actually kind of surprised we haven't done yet. We've had opportunity, and I don't know why it hasn't popped up, but somehow, a film that, by some, is considered the greatest American film ever made.
Oh, we are doing the Barney movie.
No.
Oh.
In fact, there's nobody named Barney in the movie or associated with the movie. However, it is related to Maison de Velour in that the maker of this film would sell no wine before its time. Yes.
Yeah.
We're going to watch Citizen Kane. Yep. Big thing here. Did it deserve to win over How Green Was My Valley? A film I've never seen. Have you seen that film?
No, I have not.
I'm going to have to watch that. I'm going to make the effort to do so too. My guess is right from the starting gate. No. But we're going to watch the Citizen Kane, considered one of the greatest films ever made by one of the greatest filmmakers ever made, or not, because it's been a long time.
I'm always sorry that he doesn't get Captain Kirk in the end, you know? Kane!
Max?
Yeah?
You got everything wrong.
Oh, okay.
So next week, join us when we get everything wrong here at Max
Mike Movies. The Wrath of Kane.
Shut up.
This has been a co-production of The Voice of Max and The Movie Wrench.